Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Eat Local New York podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Tringale. My guest this week is Stephen Page. Yes, that's Stephen Page. Stephen Page, musician, famous, talented. I'm sure Stephen doesn't appreciate that the first thing that I used to describe him was famous. Maybe more so I should describe him as a talented musician of fame. But Stephen Page is my guest this week. I'm really excited to have had him on the show. Reached out to him via the Instagram DMs and asked him to be on, and he said yes, obviously, because he's here today. I had a great time talking with him. You know, there's like I've said this thousands of times. I don't research guests before they come on the show. I used to. I used to plan and try and be very meticulous about, I'm going to ask them this question and this and that, and I want to research them. And I stopped doing that because the conversations, well, they weren't conversations. The podcast didn't seem to be going that well. So I never researched people. But I did with Stephen because I wanted to be able to have a knowledgeable conversation with him about the music industry, about his career, about all the things we talk about. And I'm really glad I did because it helped me stumble upon some things that I never knew that projects that he had done. One of those, which I have to say you must watch, is The Illegal Eater. It's a travel slash food show that is on, well, maybe a food traveling show or a traveling food show that's on. I purchased this the season off of Amazon Prime for $10. Stephen tells us the podcast. It's on Tubi for free. Wonderful show. If you're like me and you just watch every food-related show and movie that when it comes out, and so now you're kind of out of things to watch, this is a great one. It's about 10 years old, but it's still very, very interesting. It has me inspired for things to do and projects to maybe the start here in Central New York for this food space. And yeah, and then the final episode of the season is takes place right here in Central New York. So with some people that if you're in the food scene, you know who they are. So it's exciting. Definitely go check it out. But I researched Stephen, did some Googling to, I wanted to, you know, watch previous interviews and get a sense for what his music has been like over the past, you know, however many years. And I really wanted to listen to his latest album, Excelsior, which I've listened to at least three or four times. And I don't know if you're like me, but I found that if you listen to something over and over and over again, not only A, do I usually find a greater appreciation for it, but I can usually, it's like you become from, it's like becoming familiar with your wife or your husband, let's say. Over time, you start to notice different things about their personality and their quirks. And that's how I think, that's how it is with music. And I'm sure many other things, but how it was for me in this album that Stephen has put out. After the third or the fourth time listening to it, there were songs I was just kind of glancing over that now I was kind of really listening to and getting a deeper appreciation for it. And, you know, two of those songs, I mean, The Golden Age of Doubling Down, I don't know, just kind of like a fun, upbeat, peppy song. That I loved right off the bat. Something About Me is a song that I really appreciated, not just listening to, but the fact that he wrote something like that. So, yeah, great song, great albums. Or great songs, great album. And I highly recommend you checking that out, purchasing it. Go buy it off Stephen's website or iTunes. I don't know how that works. So there's some things I wanted to get into with Stephen. I just, like most of my guests, a lot of other things I'd like to talk to him about. We'll have to have him on again for a second episode to maybe dive into some of those things. But one of those things is, you know, royalties and streaming services and what the artists do or don't get today and just kind of getting his perspective on that world. Anyways, go as close to the source as you can to purchase your album, the album Excelsior from Stephen Page, stephenpage.com, I believe, or wherever, but buy it. Don't stream it. Buy it. Well, this is another time I'm recording this intro, the day that the episode's going out. Today is Tuesday, the 21st, which means now I have to put the episode out today. I dove into Heirloom last night. So, you know, Eddie Brennan was just in the podcast, and he was gracious enough to send me a care package of some of Heirloom's new products that they have that I know are available down in the city, I believe today, but you can't buy them. I think, ironically, you can't even buy them in Central New York. Heirloom is the business that is coming out from the Beacon Skiff fam. The property, it's their THC line of products. And so he sent me two of their four packs, which I haven't gotten into yet. He sent me the vape cartridges, which I don't vape, bro. So I passed those off to someone else. And then he sent me a bag of their little gummy edibles, and I dove into those last night, and they're 5 milligrams. I had two. You know, I was like, Monday's my day off. I spent the whole day, it was President's Day, my wife had the day off. Me and the wife and the baby hung out all day together, and when they went to bed, and I cracked a beer, and I went for a second beer, and I thought, you know, I'm going to jump into these edibles. And so I popped one, and 20, 30 minutes later, I popped another one, and man, I really enjoyed it. I'm someone who... I used to be kind of like your typical peer pressured weed smoker. I smoked in high school. I smoked later on in life, you know, like probably 23 to 25. I smoked a lot and abused it. Didn't really take it for maybe some of the other benefits. You know, it was more just like kind of a party thing, like, hey, let's get high. We've been drinking, you know, we've each had a 12 pack. Now let's go rip a bong. So that was my experience with marijuana and the devil's lettuce. And then now, you know, growing up, that sounds bad. From there, I went to work at a mega church in Texas. As most of you have listened to the podcast for a while, have heard that story before. And so I didn't smoke for a while, and I didn't even partake in anything for a while. And so... and then just moving back home, you know, when I did 7-8 years ago, I just have never really taken the time to jump into it. And so having said all that, that's the type of marijuana consumer that I have been. Now getting into Heirloom last night, I gotta say, I loved it. I mean, I felt like a nice little calm, after it kicked in, which took about 30, 45 minutes. Had a nice little calm. They tasted delicious, first of all. I hate the smell of weed and all that kind of stuff. And so these have a little bit of the bite at the very end, but for the most part, you're just getting like the pineapple-y goodness up front of the gummy. So I was feeling really nice and loose at home on the couch last night. Fell asleep on the couch and around like 8:30, which I'm usually somebody who's up till midnight. Fell asleep around 8:30. Went upstairs to bed at 9. My wife thought something was wrong with me that I was going to bed so early, but I was just in a great mood and feeling relaxed. And I slept for 10 hours last night. It was absolutely amazing. I woke up this morning feeling like I feel so relaxed and fresh and just happy. So I'm now a drug addict is my point of this episode, this intro. But I will say, Heirloom, I know nothing about the industry. I know nothing about edibles or consumables or THC or any of that kind of stuff. But I have to say, having taken them last night, I really enjoyed them. So, Eddie, if you're listening to the podcast, you should come on as a sponsor because I think that's probably a great promo that you just got for free. So, yeah, great time enjoying them. Check them out. They're on Instagram. They're on the website. You can Google it. You can go to Beacon Skiff's website, I'm sure, find the connection. Well, I don't want to talk anymore about anything else. I want to get into this week's conversation. It's the podcast. It's this podcast. It's this conversation with Stephen Page from No Restaurant, just Stephen Page, the musician. Here's the conversation. Thought about that because, like, part of the dream for this is to have I want Eat Local to be some version of like Eater and Barstool Sports, like Eater in that it's a little bit more thoughtful about food, Barstool Sports in that it's
problematic
and just constant content,
right?
You know, they've changed a lot recently. Like, I just saw they're now creating and selling their version of Pedialyte, you know, for like the day after stuff.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
I don't want to go into that direction by any stretch, but for content, I want to be able to put stuff out.
Sure.
And so part of the hope is to one day have a bit like a warehouse where we have a podcast, maybe multiple podcast sets, the bar set, kitchen set, and I've thought about the tech side of that, and without having to invest in like multiple camera setups, we create like kind of one hub where everything's just connected. It's on wheels. We can just wheel it studio to studio.
Oh, cool.
You know?
Yeah, that's great.
And that's kind of what I did with this road case for a little bit. So I had everything in here.
Yep.
And if I was going to a place to do a cooking show for like Vince's Gourmet, I just, everything went in there. I wheeled it. And then after I got it all built in here and assembled, and I went to take it out for the first time, I was like, oh shit, this is really heavy.
Yes. That's I would always like in when we would have a producer come to, let's say we were going to record in Toronto and a producer would fly in from Los Angeles and they'd show up and there'd be like racks like that, but taller, filled with all their gear. And somehow in the back of my mind, I thought, oh, this guy brought this with him. And I realized, no, they cargoed this stuff. The stuff showed up on the back of a truck and somebody else rolled it in. And they just happened to have it all set up by the time I walked into the studio. But I hadn't thought that clearly. And I was thinking the same thing. All my stuff, I once ripped a muscle in my arm trying to lift a rack like that, just not thinking, I'm just going to get it up over the corner of this bit of carpet. And not great.
Yeah. That's how I got into, when I got out of school from recording workshop, I was in Cincinnati, could not find a job. There was a Medieval Times in Cincinnati that was hiring a sound engineer for, I think, $8.75 an hour. And some weeks it might be 60 hours, some weeks it might be 30. And then that was pretty much it at the time. I could not find like a sound engineer gig to save my life.
Did you take it?
No, I did not take it.
Well, think all the free chicken you could have got. I used to love, like, my kids used to love Medieval Times. So I think I've been probably a half a dozen times.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
We almost went to, I was in Vegas last year with my brothers and cousins, and we almost went to one of their shows there at the, you know, their casino. And that was the only regret that I have, oddly enough, from Vegas, is not going to Medieval Times.
The first time I went to Medieval Times was in Anaheim because I went for the NAMM convention, the kind of music instrument convention, and I think it was Taylor Guitars or somebody that had invited me to go with it. So it was like a lot of people from the music business just laughing.
Yeah.
And so that's for me, it was just good times, but it is, it's so corny and hilarious.
Yeah. When growing up and watching Cable Guy, I always thought there was one Medieval Times. I didn't realize that there was like, you could just open a Medieval Times.
Yeah. I didn't realize that either until they opened one in Toronto.
So I was always thinking, where is that one location of Medieval Times? And turns out they're all over the place. But no,
maybe that's what we need on the waterfront instead of an aquarium.
Yeah. Don't get me started on the aquarium. So my first job was, I couldn't find a job in Cincinnati, and Craigslist, a guy was advertising his sound services and, you know, for bands. And so I called him and I said, look, and this is after I've been turned down by like 20 places. And I said, look, I just graduated from the recording workshop. You don't have to pay me. Don't call it an internship. Just tell me where you're going to be and when. I'll show up. I'll unload the gear. I'll stick around for the show, and then I'll help you load back up, and that's it.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Right. And
it's a nightmare.
Yeah. And so he said, what year? He said, you just graduated? I said, yeah. He said, I graduated from recording workshop in 86. He said, I'll be here at this sports bar this day, this time. Show up. And I showed up, helped him unload, and he let me mix that night, which, you know, was unheard of for, granted it was a sport, you know, local sports bar for a local band, but still it's unheard of to somebody to let you touch their board. And he paid me $100 that night.
That's awesome.
And so that's what I did for like a year and a half. I would, on weekends, he and I would go out and do gigs all over Cincinnati, Kentucky, you know, that whole tri-state area. And that was a blast, you know, in bars late at night. I was 20, and I'd go in there and drink for free. I'd get paid about $100 a night to help, you know, mix bands and set up.
But then you have somebody puking on your monitors or something like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, one of those nights, I think I was the person that was puking on the monitors. But, yeah. All right, so why are you in Syracuse? Why are you in Central New York?
My wife, Christine, grew up in Canastota.
Okay.
When we started seeing each other, I was here a lot. We ended up living together, I mean, she had young kids at the time, so that was made most sense for me. My kids were older and with their mom in Toronto, which is where I'm from.
Yeah.
And so I was back and forth. I spent years, 12 years probably, every other weekend back and forth to Toronto. And then anytime there was a play or sports thing or whatever, a school event up in Toronto, as well as being away on the road touring for years, where I realized, like, I lived here, but when I was home, like, I didn't want to leave the house. So I really didn't engage in the community at all. Like, I felt like both just getting a sense of what Central New York was, beyond kind of the very basics. And, like, I've had no connection really with the music community or anything else, because I was, you know, I'm home for a few days. I want to bear down and just kind of, like, enjoy my home time, and that's that. And it's only in the last, honestly, it's really the pandemic made me kind of look around a lot more, and maybe in the couple of years before that.
That's cool. Hey, make sure you check us out online on the web, Eat Local New York, spelled out, eatlocalnewyork.com. It's a great little website that we've created. You can buy your Eat Local New York card. You can save a bunch of money when you go out to restaurants. You can see all the restaurants except the Eat Local card. You can pick up some of our merch and our shirts that are coming out and all that fun stuff. You can also check out previous podcasts and blogs and recipes and all those cool food things. So head over to our website, check us out today, eatlocalnewyork.com. And now, back to the episode. Is it, have you gotten into the music scene here at much at all over the past couple of years?
I haven't really. So this is like my next phase is to start. I know that's the weird thing. I'm old now. I mean, I spent from the age of 17 until now, just like in venues late at night. The last thing if I'm home, I want to be in bed at 8 o'clock. And it's like, well, there's not much music there. But I am pushing myself to get out and see more shows.
Yeah. I would only ask because I'm curious. You know, I'll be curious maybe in the next couple of years to hear your take on it. There are some really talented musicians, but in Central New York, I've always said Syracuse has kind of a weird music and art scene. I compare it to when I was in high school listening to Dashboard Confessional and then trying to mimic and play that on my guitar, and I was always playing the shitty version of that song.
Yep.
That's kind of how I felt some of the music, because I don't hear a lot of original artists. You know, I hear mostly covers, especially in the restaurant industry when you're booking, you know, a two-piece for $600 for the night. You're mostly hearing covers.
My sense is, and this is as an outsider who's not part of the scene, so I certainly don't want to offend anybody, but my sense is, and this is also maybe it's relevant to the food as well, it's a community where you have a large portion are connected to the university, which in a lot of ways it has zero connection to the city at large.
Yes.
You know, they are the second largest employer in Syracuse and area in Onondaga County, and they have this huge population that comes in and out and really doesn't connect. There are a few places, sports and Syracuse Stage, places like that where they do actually kind of intersect with the city.
Yeah.
But in general, they don't. So you have artists who are part of the university, for example, and there have been several over the years that have had success outside. But then they leave.
Right.
At the end of their fourth year.
Yeah.
And then you have people here, we're close enough to New York City where you can go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a little bit of that classic sense of the desire. People who grew up here are a lot of them desire to leave.
Yeah.
And you see it all over the place. It's a classic thing in the UK, and you see that with all those bands and films and stuff where people are in the north somewhere and their whole desire was to move to London.
Yeah.
You know, until quite recently, that was the way music happened. You know, music would get ignored outside of London. And, you know, same kind of thing. And I'm from Toronto, which is the nexus of all kinds of culture and music and food and whatever else in Canada. But most artists have to move somewhere in order to be the thing. So what you end up getting in individual towns is a lot of cover bands or people who've stayed there for a different reason, not for the music.
Yeah.
Not for the... And, you know, anything else, they're there because of a different job or family health concerns, whatever the things might be, and they still play music, which is great. But there is that sense of like it's not necessarily innovative,
right?
Because there isn't a scene to nurture that.
Yeah.
And that's me on an outside the scene, and somebody's going to say, "You're not paying attention to this group of people here who are." And yeah. I want to find out about them.
Yeah, was that like your hopes in the early days of, the Bare Naked Ladies in Canada? Was it kind of thinking of like, hey, how do we get out of here? How do we get bigger? Or was it just kind of trying to create fun and great music?
No, I would say we definitely wanted to get out of there. I think there's a weird thing that happens when you're a kid. I mean, we were 18 when we started the group.
Yeah.
You have to kind of be psychotically narcissistic in a way. We always had, like, we loved the sense of community from the other bands that we played with and met along the way. Would always, if we had some success, we'd try and bring them along. And this is the early 90s. It's the time of the Kurt Cobain t-shirt. You know, he was notorious for always, like, wearing some unknown band's t-shirt, and it would give them a lift. Mm. And we did this, you know, we certainly weren't Nirvana. We were light. But but we still were part of the indie spirit. And for us, the indie spirit was like, hey, we're going to wear a punk band's t-shirt in our video in order to get kids to listen to them. Or we'd bring them out on the road as our opening act. But we grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, and we would go downtown to play shows, and we would see, this is the end of the 80s, it's kind of the Joshua Tree era of rock and roll. Everybody's very serious, pictures are black and white, leather jackets, tousled mullets, and we were like, hey, we're crazy kids from the suburbs. And we were like, our whole shtick was, we're not going to lie. Like, everybody else is getting back in their car and going to their mom's house after the gig too. But we're not going to pretend that we're cool.
Yeah.
And audiences kind of went, hey, that's us too. Like, people connected with it. But we knew early on that we could easily, there was a great scene happening in Toronto. Bands like Blue Rodeo, Cowboy Junkies, Tragically Hip, all kind of happening in Toronto at the time. It was a certain kind of rootsy, post-REM Americana kind of thing that was happening for the most part. And we could have stayed in that and probably done well inside that community. Record companies in Canada always saw us as kind of an embarrassment. Like they said, they were like, these guys are a novelty act. They're not going to last. We're not going to sign them because it's just a fad. So we just went, well, to hell with this. We're going to not be a Toronto band. We always saw this image of the Toronto band in Canada as being that kind of like the rest of Canada would resent them. So we thought, we'll be a Canadian band. We'll get out there and play across the country wherever we can, whether it's a college pub or a bowling alley or a community center or a Legion Hall. Doesn't matter. We'll go and play everywhere, far north, east, west. And we were lucky at that time. There was things like Much Music, which was the Canadian MTV that would show our stuff coast to coast, or CBC Radio would actually play young artists like us. So it was a way for us to get exposure outside of Toronto. But Canada's a small country.
Yeah.
You know, there's 26 million people. It's more now, but and so our success there let's say you play Saskatoon at the University Pub in September, and then you come back and play the Broadway Theater in February, and then you come back again in July and play some outdoor fair, and then you have a new album that comes out and you want to come back, and nobody comes to the gig because they've just seen you three times. Where in America, there's like, oh, you've played Syracuse twice? How about Rochester? How about Ithaca? How about, you're like, you can just go, you can go drive an hour and a half and have a completely different audience.
Yeah.
It was like when things started to wane for us in Canada about 95, we just spent all our time down here in the U.S., which is a funny thing, like coming to live here and I live in Manly, and it's like, oh, Jamesville Balloon Fest. I played there in 1997 or something like that. Or just places around. I played just about every SUNY campus with BNL in the 90s. And now I just, everywhere I am, played there.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was, I think we all kind of jump to whatever the thing is. Like, I'm not an old man by any stretch of the imagination. I'm 36, but I'm old enough to be like back in my day with some things. And so today with like TikTok and Instagram Reels, and I say this, you know, Nicole is like the young voice of Eat Local New York, even though she's older than I am. But Nicole has come on this year and saved my ass. And so now all these videos we're putting out are, and, you know, because of her. But we're putting out these videos where
I need to take some tips from you, Nicole.
Before the post, it was like a photo and maybe, you know, it was a little bit more thoughtful. And now it's like, we just got to get a video out and we have to do something that's going to try and get attention. And so today I'm thinking to myself, man, things today, it's just about trying to get attention. It's so annoying. And then I was, as I was going through the history of the band and, you know, kind of the progression, the gig at, you know, City Hall, where they wanted to, you know, take you all off the list because of the name of the band, the Bare Naked Ladies. I'm like, oh wait, that's been happening for years. It was just,
oh totally. Like TikTok freaks me out. I look at it and go, I don't know how I could, because I want to just like, hey everybody, here's what, which is not the TikTok thing. Right. And then I think, well, how am I gonna? I know how to do it. I just don't have the concentration anymore. But as a young person, like if Bare Naked Ladies was starting now, I think we would have just relished every possibility out there, because that was the kind of thing we would do. What you're alluding to is in 91, we were supposed to play New Year's Eve at outside of City Hall in Toronto. It was always a big concert. I remembered watching it as a teenager, and there'd be, you know, tens of thousands of people there. So it was a big deal. And we didn't have a major label album out. And I was alluding to earlier about how the Canadian labels didn't like us. Yeah. It was eventually Sire Records in New York, Seymour Stein, who signed us. And then all of a sudden we had credibility in Canada. They're like, whoa, what's going on here? The guy who signed Madonna and the Talking Heads likes this stupid band that we make fun of? And he did. And they were really supportive. And we had a great long run with them. But so we were supposed to play this New Year's show. And then this was around the time of, this would be 91, so the time of like Andrew Dice Clay and that kind of stuff. And people were, there was this sense of like, somebody was offended by the name of the band. Yeah. They thought it was, that it objectified women. But they kind of made us poster boys for anti-PC. Like, and I was like, I don't want to be that. all that PC stuff you're talking about, I kind of, like, that's where my values are. It's just, you know, and we certainly wouldn't, I'm sure we wouldn't be naming the band that now if we were starting now. I'm lucky that I'm not part of it. I don't have to worry about that. I'm not in the group. But anyways, that was a big thing, and we got a lot of publicity out of it.
Yeah.
And at the time, we were really embarrassed by the publicity because we weren't in control of it.
Yeah.
And we thought it was putting a spotlight on the thing we didn't care about, like with just our dumb name, as opposed to the music or the vibes of the show or anything else. And I think people wanted us to speak out as like anti-PC activists, which we were not. So people would always say, oh, that City Hall thing really got you guys your break. And we hated that.
Yeah.
But they were right. Like in Canada, it,
yeah,
we already thought we were a household name, but we weren't. After that City Hall thing, we absolutely were. But we used to do stuff like we would do, if we had a gig on Queen Street in Toronto at the Rivoli Club, and we were worried that maybe people didn't know we were playing there, we would stand out on the street and busk in the afternoon with a sign saying, we're playing here tonight, come back and see us. Or we would go to like a convention, went to the New Music Seminar in New York City, and we would offer wake-up calls. So people would sign up for wake-up. It's humiliating when I think about it now, but we had no shame. We would go to strangers' hotel rooms in the music business at like 8 a.m. and sing Be My Yoko Ono at their door. Just like, what were we thinking? But we did it.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of the same thing today, though.
That's right.
It's just in a different format.
That's right. It's very TikTok. It's like it is that kind of thing of just taking advantage of any opportunity and putting your personality out there.
Yeah.
Is very much like what our ethic was at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. How does that change, or how does that affect your songwriting? You know, like, and yeah, how does that affect your songwriting when you're looking at it? Like, as an artist, if you're trying to put out like a really specific song, mm-hmm. you're trying to say something with this, you know, tune. Well, I guess that's kind of like I've been reading some of the articles, you know, that's kind of like how you all were, how the band was portrayed with your songs. It was like really intentional on the musicality of each song,
right?
But not so much with like the lyrics or the message. It was more like having fun. So was that kind
of... Well, it would be... sometimes it would be the opposite of that, too, because sometimes the songs would... Because the music seemed fun, mm-hmm. and the lyrics might be complex, they might be depressing, mm-hmm. they might be dealing with dark topics, people often wouldn't hear that. And then, like, later, I'd have people saying to me, like, well, I was singing that song in the backseat of my parents' car when I was 10, and about 5 years ago, I looked at the lyrics and I was like, what was I singing out loud in my parents' car?
Yeah.
There was an element of that, too. I think what we struggled with then was that we created the image mm-hmm. of being fun-loving and energetic and whatever else. And then we, particularly me, I would complain that then no one was paying attention to the seriousness of the music mm-hmm. or the sensitivity and the poetry and the lyrics. Like, so, well, what do you expect?
Right.
You're jumping around in your shorts, like, you know, like it's a kid's TV show.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to write a Morrissey song mm-hmm. and complaining that people aren't getting it. But at the time, that was exactly where I was at. Because I was like, you can have, rightfully so, I thought, you can have all of those things.
Yeah.
You know, a great novel has laughs and has tears. You know, I think about my favorite records, like records like, you know, an album like Abbey Road can have a song like I Want You, She's So Heavy, and can have Maxwell Silver Hammer or Octopus's Garden. Mm. And knowing, I mean, people might skip over one or two of those songs, but they're not going to go, well, that's just a novelty record.
Yeah. I was thinking about that this morning as I was listening to the song we were talking about, and I have a terrible memory, so I apologize. It's All About Me.
Something About Me.
Something About Me. And as I'm listening to the song and I'm ironing my shirt, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is about me, which we've talked about how ironic that is. And then at the end of it, where it's talking about, you know, I'm assuming, right, suicide, uh-huh. I was like, holy shit, that just slapped me in the face. That is a heavy, that is a heavy song at the end. And then I'm like starting to think through, okay, like, you know, is this about someone he knows? Is this just like kind of following the story? And then all of a sudden I start thinking about, you know, people that I know who, and it's going into like throughout my own life of people I know have committed suicide. And it's like from the golden age of Doubling Down to that. And then this song where I'm thinking about it and myself. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, this is this really intense ending to the song that now is making me really think about all of a sudden people that I in my life or that I know of who have committed suicide. And then what was now I'm like contemplating that entire thing. Like, I mean, it was kind of like that for me this morning and the hour and a half that I was listening to everything and getting ready of that laughs and this is a really fun upbeat song. And then holy cow, now I'm really contemplating life. I mean,
that I've done my job.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, those two songs particularly, I was just thinking a lot about how, and when I say, I often say we, but I really mean me. Like I'm not super active. Like I used to be a kind of a Twitter addict, mm-hmm. not always interjecting myself in there, but I've learned just from the, you know, I just can't, my skin is too thin.
Yeah.
But even just looking at stuff and whatever, somebody famous dies and I've got to like somehow tell a story on social media about my connection with that person. Mm-hmm. Well, then I just turn their death into me. And so I'm constantly having to kind of put the brakes on that, but we see it everywhere, whether it's in the kind of the anger in the discourse. I mean, let's talk about my favorite Facebook group. We'll go nameless. It's like,
are you a part of that group?
What group are you talking about? This coffee is delicious, but you know what the best thing is? Make it at home. This coffee is a hidden gem.
Oh my God, that is absolutely hilarious. That Stephen Page is a part of that Facebook group.
I actually did not go on Facebook for several years. I basically spent the entire pandemic not on Facebook. On my professional page occasionally.
Yeah.
But once I realized I could upload a post from Instagram directly to Facebook.
Yeah.
I would answer questions sometimes, but for the most part, it's like it starts to get messy really quick. But the only time I go on now is to check out that Facebook group.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. It's a hidden gem.
Yeah. I've had a lot of love-hate over the years with that Facebook group. And
but I like people whose desire right away or I see like just is just to engage in battling people.
Right.
And that's what like both of those songs are about. That and you think, well, what purpose does it serve? Mm-hmm. I guess it serves something in me.
Yeah.
But somebody else's pain or somebody else's problem or somebody else's, somehow I take it on myself. Maybe I think I'm trying to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I still just, I've now taken the spotlight away from them. And that's, and so it's about me checking myself more than anything else. And so when I turned it to suicide, as often I do, because you know, I'm somebody who's struggled with mental health issues my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that age-old battle we have. We say, well, is that a selfish thing? Mm-hmm. Or is that a way that we relieve ourselves of pain? I don't know.
Hmm.
I mean, there are so many questions about that. But I love leaving open-ended questions because listeners aren't dumb. They you know, you need to kind of give them space to come to their own conclusions.
Yeah. Hmm. That's really interesting. It's it really, I mean, yeah, like we were talking about before, there's probably time, you know, I may have listened to that song once or twice and never really contemplated it. And the fourth or fifth time of going through it, I'm like really getting into the lyrics and thinking about, you know, what it is. Is it, I'm a bit of a musician myself, Stephen.
What do you play?
Nothing anymore. Back in the day, I grew up in church. And so my parents were, and my whole family, my brother and sister-in-law and my sister are all ministers, and my parents too. But growing up as a kid, it was like the thing that my family excelled at was hospitality. My dad was a chef and restaurant owner, and so there's one thing they know to do is like take care of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we grew up with that in church. It was like, hey, we're gonna go to church whenever the doors are open, but we're gonna volunteer whenever the doors are open.
Awesome.
So for me, trying to figure that out when I was a kid and like had my first guitar, it was okay, I'll join the band, and then that carried me through probably 25, you know, from like 16 to 25, different churches, you know, worship leader, all that kind of stuff. And where was I going with the story?
I don't know, but I like it.
Yeah, I forget where.
No, I was want to ask about your pedal board because worship guitarists always have the best pedal boards.
I bought the, I forget the brand, but the one where it was like five, it was like every effect that you could ever imagine in one board.
Oh, nice. Like a line six?
Yeah. I had that for like a week and quickly realized that, you know, maybe it was the grace of God that, you know, you shouldn't have this. And so the only pedal I ever rocked when I played guitar was just my tuner. And then I played bass for a little bit. So I had, you know, my black box yellow lettering.
Sansamp.
Yeah. So I had that going for a little bit. This is where I go into the story. When I was like 24 and I was like getting more into church and like kind of developing my thought process of what I thought about Christianity and faith and all those kind of things, I wanted to stop playing songs because what I found was like I couldn't say what I wanted to say. Like everything I wanted to say about faith or anything like that or spirituality or Christianity from the stage had to come through a song. And you know, if you're in that position and you're trying to maybe say something through a song and not just trying to, you know, put in ourselves in the perspective of Christianity, if you're trying to do anything from that position other than just like bring people into the presence of God, then there's probably something wrong with what you're doing. But I wanted to stop because I realized I didn't want what I was saying or singing to be interpreted. I wanted to like say what I meant and I wanted you to get it.
Right. Yeah. That's a hard thing to overcome with writing songs. I think I used to feel that way, that there was a right way to hear what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there is, like sometimes people will hear a song and they'll go, oh, that's creepy or whatever. And mm-hmm. you think, well, no, it's more than that. Like, you know, I might be telling a story. I'm not telling you about my life or whatever. Mm-hmm. About my, you know, I'm telling you a story so you feel unsettled. Like, and people write stuff off. But that's up to them. That's their own. That just describes how they choose to listen to music. Mm-hmm. And I like, as a listener, either just letting the feeling wash over me or digging in and trying to figure it out. Mm. And being told, no, that's not what it's about, is a weird thing. It changes the way you have to hear that song forever. So I'm aware now. Here's the thing now. I find it more difficult to write a song if I know the thing I'm trying to say, because I spend all the time trying to get to that, like an argument or an illustration of something. And I feel like it ends up becoming a very technical song. And as soon as I can remind myself that it doesn't matter what I know, like what the individual facts are in it, but what matters is what I feel. And as long as I can communicate that without using words like I feel blank, you know, like you can still communicate that by painting a picture. And that's when songs are successful. Successful, and I don't mean on the charts, but I just mean as a piece of art. So I have to let go. So those two songs that we were talking about, which have lots of specificity in them, the Golden Age of Doubling Down took me a long time to write because I knew what I wanted to say. And I was frustrated at how it becomes prosaic and it loses its poetry. And poetry, there's lots of room for interpretation.
Yeah.
And once I was okay with people just interpreting it however they like, I'm happier playing it.
Yeah.
It is a matter of letting go, and that's a hard thing to do sometimes.
Yeah. Hey, have you downloaded the Eat Local New York app? If you haven't, what are you doing? It's a great way to connect with all the restaurants that accept the Eat Local New York card. You can see where you are in the restaurants that are participating in your general area, along with finding the full list of restaurants and finding links for the podcast right here. So it's the easiest way to go find the podcast. Just download the Eat Local New York app, go there, listen to the podcast, and then check out places in restaurants where you can save money when you go out to eat. Download the Eat Local New York app today. And now back to the episode. I feel that same way sometimes in some of the posts that we make, you know, where it's like we'll get comments or, you know, things people will say certain things. It's like, well, we meant this, you know. I think that's maybe I haven't thought about art like this, you know, running a business, working in restaurants. It's really like, okay, you do this, you do that, it's out there, you're done, right? And so my mind hasn't really been in an artistic mode in quite some time, and it hasn't really, honestly, listening to this album for the past 3 weeks has really shifted that, which I'm really grateful for.
Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you for saying yes to the podcast, because that forced me to listen to this album for over and over again. But it's has it ever been challenging over the past, like, let's say, decade, to, or even like over the past 2 years with everything you've been doing over, you know, Zoom? And has it been challenging to try to like kind of find that artistic way of kind of skirting around things and not just trying to get to the point?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think in a way, I've been so busy with different projects. One thing I did was I co-wrote a musical that was, it was actually in 2020, we were in rehearsals for it to actually be in production. It was at the Stratford Festival in Canada, which is the biggest classical theater festival in North America. And they had commissioned this musical. And when you're writing songs for musical theater, it's an interesting thing because there is a slightly different, even if you're writing in your own idiom, like your own style of music, there's the songs have a purpose. And they always say it's about pushing the story forward.
Yeah.
But the way you push the story forward doesn't have to be saying, hey, I'm walking down the street now and here I see a guy and I'm going to talk to him. Like, where there is that sense of like it could just be the narration, but we can see that on the stage. What you have to do is sing the feelings that you can't speak. And that is supposed to somehow help develop the character or push the story arc forward. And that really taught me a lot. I mean, I already thought I knew how to write songs, but it does change your perspective. And you think, well, what's like some of that I was already doing, because for me, the arc of a three verse song with a bridge and choruses, already has an arc. Mm-hmm. But it might be, when I would write a song, it might be a self-contained arc, as if like the whole musical was contained inside of 3.5 minutes of my song. Mm. Well, now I'm able to spread it out, take some time, really dig into some feelings. So that taught me a lot. But then, yes, with the pandemic, and I was so focused on doing these live from home concerts every Saturday, live from home number 100 coming up March 18th. Hmm. It's going to be a big one.
That's awesome.
Doing that, and I was doing a lot of, like, I would do a brand new opening song with a video that I would make for it that was kind of topical. Because that was the feeling of the time. And that was important to do. But it was taking away from my ability to finish what I considered kind of quote-unquote real songs or album songs. They're all real.
So
it wasn't until like basically a year ago from right now where I went, okay, I had all these songs coming into the pandemic that I was ready to make an album out of. And then I kind of stopped. I mean, I think everybody slowed down at the beginning. Like, yeah. It just felt like we were walking through oatmeal.
Yeah.
For the first few months of the pandemic. And then I started doing this live streams, which gave me lots of inspiration and kept me going, got me out of bed and kept me sane. But I wasn't finishing the record.
Yeah.
So I really cracked down in the first half of last year just to finish it off. And that was a lot of work, because just to shift the way your head works and what, you know, digging into not only the lyrics, but the music. And I played virtually everything on this record except for the cello, which is my friend Kevin Fox.
Yeah. I was thinking about that when I heard the melodica. I was like, oh, I wonder how many of the instruments he played on this, because that's one thing that's got to be maybe a little easier but challenging in different ways, especially from the pandemic, is especially if you have your own setup and you're talented enough to play these different instruments, is I can do it, you know.
Well, that was like, that was going to be a flute part. And then I have a flute and I played flute in high school. My flute is in terrible shape. And so is my embouchure.
Yeah.
So I tried it. I was like, nope, I'm going to try melodica for now. There's a lot of like, oh, try this. And then you get used to it. You go, this is good. Yeah. I don't need to change it.
I went through a phase of buying any instrument that I could. I learned, I was at a church and the bass player quit and left the church on a Friday. And he was supposed to be there Sunday. And we had two guitarists. I was one of them. And so we didn't have a bass player. And I said, I'll go buy a bass. And so I went and bought a bass at the local music store. And I had on my music stand the diagram of the bass fretboard and where each note was on it. And that's how I played bass. That was it.
I have a poster, a really wrinkled up poster with all the same thing, where all the notes are on the bass. And then like a few years ago, I always wanted a bass. Like when I was 13, I would see Tina Weymouth in the Talking Heads playing bass, and like I want to play bass.
Yeah,
but for some reason, I never bought one until 10 years ago, and I thought, well, I don't know how to play this thing. But then eventually, I'm not even thinking about it. I'm just trying to play bass part, fit the thing. You think, oh, I can play bass. What am I like? I don't know why. Yeah. Like, something in me said you can't play this, and then I started to over prepare, over learn, like theoretically, as opposed to just doing the work on the instrument.
Yeah,
it still takes me forever to lay down a bass part. But
oh, really?
No one's watching.
I mean, it's the easiest to learn, hardest to master, right? Isn't that what they say about it?
Well, that's the other thing is I was in Bare Naked Ladies. Jim Cregan is just such a brilliant bass player, and Doug Elliott from The Odds, who I play with all the time, like I think one of the greatest bass players in all of rock. So I get to play with these guys who have great taste, great technique, great style. And, you know, here I am. But I do a different thing. I'm not trying to do what they do.
What's that like? I mean, when you're going to play with other incredible musicians, is it still kind of intimidating of like walking up on stage or in rehearsals and thinking to yourself, what the hell am I doing here?
Well, yeah, like I did these records with a group in Toronto called the Art of Time Ensemble, and it's led by a classical pianist named Andrew Barashko. And it's a mix of essentially the best classical players and the best jazz players, and then they would have vocalists from the pop and rock world, like myself, come in. And I did one record called The Singer Must Die, which is all they let me choose 10 covers that I've always wanted to do. And then got contemporary classical arrangers to do the arrangements for this group.
Wow.
So you're going in and playing, singing with all these amazing artists. And at first it's totally intimidating. But once you realize that you're all there to do the same thing, which is do the best work possible, and that I'm doing something that they couldn't do, mm-hmm. and that they're doing something I couldn't do, but together we can do this new thing, it's amazing. But it does take some time to and I thought maybe I had to kind of like meet them halfway. You know, I grew up singing. I took voice lessons and I sang in choirs and stuff. So I thought maybe I need to put my classical voice on to sing this. And it's like, just be yourself as they're being there themselves. But this past year, I got invited to sing at a gala for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's, which was, I mean, amazing because, I mean, he's a hero and Canadian hero at that. And, you know, just it's Michael J. Fox. And it turns out that he and his family have been fans for a long time, and it's pretty awesome that way. But get go there to do this, and the house band is led by Steve Jordan on drums, who is now the drummer in the Rolling Stones. You know, and was the drummer in the original Letterman band, and produces like just one of the great music producers.
I didn't know that he was playing with the Rolling Stones. Now.
So he's Keith Richards' producer and drummer.
Oh my god!
And has now has replaced Charlie Watts in the Rolling Stones, and he's the music director. And so we're up, and he's and he's so nice. And I realize like, oh, I'm thinking I'm imposter syndrome big time, but he just treats me like another musician, a peer. And in the band is like Isaiah Sharkey on guitar, who plays with John Mayer, Jamaluddin Takuma on bass, who played with Ornette Coleman, and Ray Parker Jr. on guitar. Heavyweights. And it's just amazing. And I go and sing my songs with them, and it's like all smiles. Everybody's into it. And then we're supposed to end. The finale was Wilson Pickett, Land of a Thousand Dances. Well, I mean, it comes up on the teleprompter, and I think, who's singing? Am I singing back up in this? And Steve Jordan's behind the drum kit. He goes, okay, Steve. And it's like, oh, fuck, it's me. And so I have to sing this, like a rock and soul song.
That's happening in rehearsal or on stage?
Both. But like it was on stage in the dress rehearsal. I'm like, oh. And then I pulled it off, and they're like, that was great. And I'm like, did all my imposter syndrome just leave? I hope this doesn't go to my head because it was so good.
But
doing it felt like felt so good because I'm playing with the best of the best. But then also the fact that I was accepted as a peer is like still shocking to me 35 years into my career.
Wow, that's wild. My I've got my cousins who live in Cincinnati still, Daniel and Crystal Peterson. Crystal had a bit of a career. She was on a couple, did a couple Disney soundtracks or songs for him. The Princess Diaries, the song Supergirl, that's her. She opened for the Backstreet Boys for a world tour 1 year. That's a story for you. But anyway, she did a lot of work and toured with Victor Wooten and a lot of his stuff. And just thinking about, like, my cousin Daniel, who's one of the best drummers I've ever, you know, met in my life, thinking about the two of them working with Victor Wooten, I'm like, and this is years ago, but I've always tried to wrap my head around like what that must feel like. Those two who are masterful, accomplished musicians, to be standing on the same stage or in the same room playing, producing, recording with Victor Wooten or anybody. I mean, I couldn't imagine that feeling, you know. I mean, no matter how talented a person is at their craft, to be on stage with someone else who's so much more equally, that's got to be an unreal experience.
Well, I think that the secret is understanding that, like I was saying before, you're doing something that is, I mean, somebody else could be in your position.
Yeah.
It could be somebody else taking your place, but they're not going to do it exactly the same way you will.
Yeah.
So bring what you have, and it's going to be unique and hopefully inspiring to that other person. You know, I did this years ago, Tom Jones did a duets album. And I found myself in the control room of a recording studio standing next to Tom Jones singing Little Green Bag. you know, the song from the beginning of Reservoir Dogs. And I mean, his voice is huge. And he's got a big barrel chest, and it sounds like it's just bang. But we played off each other,
yeah.
And you know, there was lots of riffing and stuff, and humor and energy, and that was like he gave that to me because he was so big and commanding, and I gave stuff back to him that inspired him. And you realize like this recording would not have been the same if it had been any other musician singing with him.
Yeah,
that we did bring something that was unique, and it may not be better or worse than anybody else, but it just is what it is.
Was there a time when you didn't have that perspective?
Yeah, probably that then. I did not then. I think I've had that perspective for about 4 years. I never understood how to be, it sounds weird, I think, now to me, but I don't think I ever really understood how to be both, have humility and confidence. I didn't know that those two could exist together. I always thought that, like, if I brought any confidence to the room, that it would come across as like ego. And if I mean, ego is part of it, but I mean, you know, like a competitive sense of ego.
Yeah.
I had to bring this kind of humility that was self-deprecating, would then also reflect like a lack of confidence, which ends up being a lack of professionalism.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's just my own problem.
Yeah.
But I think we all, as musicians, bring a lot of those kinds of problems into the room, and they're not helpful.
Yeah.
They're not helpful to any of the other musicians there, and they're not helpful to your performance. The more I can kind of encourage the people around me to go, hey, we're all professionals here. Let's do something out of this mixture of people that can't happen anywhere else except for right here and right now. And like I was saying to musicians I was playing with the other day, I said, we're going to make 1,000 mistakes in the next 45 minutes. And then when that's over, it won't have mattered because we're going to have loved every second of it. Because otherwise people get so wrapped up in, especially like, you know, if I'm the boss and they're all trying to kind of like, not impress me, they're just trying to do the best they can so they don't disappoint me. Well, I'm not going to be disappointed. It's too late to be disappointed about anything like that anymore.
Yeah.
I get to enjoy time on stage, and I want that to be infectious. And I spent so many years with kind of a dark cloud over my head. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really easy to piss me off on stage or piss myself off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into this negative spiral. And it's just like, whatever. I don't know. In the last bunch of years, it's just gone away.
Yeah.
I mean, I still have to work at it. I still have to remind myself. But in general, it's just like, so that's the thing. If there are moments where you can be inspired by another musician, just take them. And I think the best musicians understand that. That it's not even about paying your dues or how well you play your instrument or whatever else. There's always something you can learn from somebody else.
This is a much more enlightening conversation than I was ready for this morning. I think it's all that fucking song this morning. That's when I was ironing my shirt. This entire day is going to be that. I mean, I get that 100%. I can think of like times in years past playing at church of all things, and you know, drummer messes something up, hits this, you know, somebody goes off key, whatever the case is, and it's like infuriating. But I think about that a lot now. In the past 2 months of now, you know, we opened 31 Fried, which is a restaurant inside of a restaurant, back in April. And that was a lot of fun coming up with the concept, coming up with the recipes. But then I'm a partner in that restaurant, so just kind of turning it over to someone else to kind of, you know, hopefully you're going to do everything correctly. And then now in the new year, I've stepped into the role of like running that restaurant and running the Limp Lizard barbecue that my restaurant exists inside of. And so I found myself at times going into the day, like I'm up there at 6 a.m. getting the briskets or the ribs or whatever on the smoker and getting like thinking, okay, this has to go in here. This has to go in here. If this time is off, we're fucked, you know.
And which location is that?
So the Limp Lizard in North Syracuse. Okay. So I've been connected to the Limp Lizard for a few years now, just doing some stuff with them. You know, with Eat Local, we work with 150 restaurants across the state.
Awesome.
And with our discount card, if a restaurant chooses to accept the card and the you know, offer the discount to our cardholders, they get free photography and videography from us whenever they want. There's only like two restaurants that have ever taken us up on it, and Limp Lizard was one of them. So I've been doing some stuff with them for a while, and we've done some events. And long story short, that's how I was able to get connected to them to open 3-1 Fried, and then now to run their North Syracuse spot.
Cool.
And it's been fun. It's I lived in Central Texas for about 3 or 4 years. I was a stage manager at a mega church.
Nice.
Yeah. And some of my favorite moments were handing the microphone to the performer right before the guest speaker. And those would be like Aaron Lindsay and CC Winans and, you know, people like that. So
wow.
I was the guy that handed them the microphone, told them how to turn it on. It's a lot of fun.
And then you hope that the person at the desk has actually got the right one up.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But did you eat some great brisket and sausage when you were there?
Yeah. And I, you know, 3-4 years there of like great Mexican food, great barbecue. You know, I was in Killeen, and so it just 45 minutes north of Austin. So I've always like longed for that style of barbecue here. And so that's what we're in the process of doing out in North Syracuse, is trying to make it more like a Central Texas style barbecue.
Cool.
You know, starting this week, we're doing by the pound now. Along with like the typical platters that you have to get at barbecue joints in the Northeast. Because people, I think a lot of people, if they go into a place and it's like that all you can order is barbecue by the pound in this area, they'd lose their minds.
Yeah.
So we're going to start adding by the pound, but everything's coming with Wonder Bread, sliced white onions, pickles, you know, heavy focus on the smoking, the barbecue, and that kind of stuff. So,
nice.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun. But I've, in getting those things dialed in and kind of like, I've had to catch myself a lot of saying, okay, I can't control everything that's going to happen. I need to do my best because we're serving people food, but I can't control every little nuance of how this stuff's going to happen and how, you know, that we're going to go from here to there and put out this final product to this customer that hopefully they love. So I need to kind of give up a little bit and just enjoy the fact that I'm here doing something I love doing, making food and serving it to people.
If you bring angst and negativity to everything you do, it the product is going to exude that.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I think I know that the kitchen culture is going through a reckoning right now.
Yeah.
And for the better. I mean, but those of us at the top of any creative business like that, where it is a collaborative thing, but it might be your face on the poster,
yeah,
or your name above the door. It all starts from the top, and in my experience, the more everybody else feels rewarded by the work environment and the kind of, they start to take pride in the product that's being made, that everybody wants to do the best work possible, you end up with, I think, the best results, because everybody's invested in it. If everybody's paid well, everybody's taken care of, and people aren't getting yelled at or on stage, it's the stink eye, which I was the king of the stink eye. It's like someone, you know, whatever, they make one mistake and you look at them as if like somehow giving them the stink eye is going to correct the thing that just happened.
Yeah.
They already feel bad. oh, let me see, how do I make it feel worse right now?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Like I said, a day of me learning a lot of things and self-reflection. Thank you, Stephen Page, for doing that.
Pleasure.
All right. So
I'm just passing on what I've been learning. It's like I'm certainly not perfect, but
yeah,
learning how to do it. And it's like, oh, this is easier.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is like when things are done with empathy and compassion and lightness and a sense of excitement, everything works out better.
Yeah.
You know, you can't you show up at the gig and your whatever, the luggage was lost and your guitars didn't show up. It's hard to be upbeat about that. But don't yell at your bass player because of something Air Canada did.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. And true. All right, I've got 1,000 more questions, but I'm not going to hold you here for those. So I've got 2 last questions.
Yeah.
The first question is, and David from Peachtree Sandwich Company wanted me to ask this to every guest I have on the podcast, and that is, why do you do what you do?
I don't know if I have a choice. Like I love it. I mean, there was a time when I would think, oh, it was a painful thing to do too. But no, I love every day of making music. And like, I have a studio space here. in Syracuse that I used to do everything out of my basement. Mm-hmm. And then when I was started doing the live streams, I started doing the shows just took over my whole basement. I couldn't do anything else. I thought, well, I'm going to get out of the house. Also, I couldn't disconnect work life from home life. Mm-hmm. And the house was overrun with merch and whatever. Let's just get a space. And I got the space, and I love to go there every day and just touch my stuff, mm-hmm. play the guitar, write a song, work on a project. Mm. It feels it feels healthy to me to do it. I don't love going away from home anymore. As the older I get and the more okay I am with my own life, luckily I'm with people I enjoy doing it with. That's the other thing is music gives me the chance to be around people that I really enjoy being around. Mm. It's one of my favorite things is to continuously learn, and music gives me a chance to learn something new every day.
Mm. That's awesome. All right, last question is, where can people find tour dates and get the album and all that fun stuff?
All right, latest album, Excelsior, featuring the front cover is all photos from Central New York. Mm. Taken by my wife, Christine Munn.
Awesome.
There you go. They're all local pictures on the front, and the back is all pictures from my childhood. Available from my website, stephenpage.com. Stephenpage.shop is my web store, but all the tour dates are there. We're going to be playing a bunch of shows, me and my trio, in March, April, May. End of April, beginning of May, playing a few shows around here. Clayton, New York, up at the Clayton Opera House. I think that's May 6th or something like that. And right before that, North Tonawanda, if you're going to go over to Western New York, beautiful Riviera Theater. Those are the ones in the area.
Awesome. Yeah. And if you're like me and you've exhausted every cooking and eating show that exists on streaming platforms, go to Amazon Prime and purchase the first season of Illegal Eater. It's $10, and it is massively enjoyable.
I think it's still free on Tubi. If anybody has Tubi, which I don't have it, but I think it's free on that.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. Otherwise, you can get it from Amazon Prime.
And final episode shot right here in Syracuse.
You got it. You can see how things have changed over the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
Well, there it is, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the Local New York Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Stephen Page. Again, hope to have him on again in the future to talk about some more things that were on my mind, and I'd love to get his perspective on in the food industry and the music industry and all of those things. Talk to him about food critics and great food here in Central New York. All right, that's it. Thank you so much for checking out the episode and the Eat Local New York Podcast. Make sure you subscribe whatever platform you're listening to this on, and check us out online at eatlocalnewyork.com. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to catch you back here next week for another episode of the Eat Local New York Podcast. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.